Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm now joined by Alex Stewart.
Good morning, Joe.
Seb Stafford-Blaw.
Hi, Joe.
Ha! Welcome to a new week. It's a Tuesday and we're recording this on a Monday. We'll be taking you through the weekend's action today by discussing such fixtures as Manchester City-West Ham, Tottenham versus Burnley, Chelsea versus Manchester United, Luke Shaw versus Stuart Atwell, and RB Leipzig versus Borussia Mönchengladbach. It's all very exciting, apart from one bit where Seb talks about handball for too long after I encouraged him to do that. And at the end, of course, we come to Joe's Flax and Quotes database too, except I forgot to do a quote. So it's been a fun episode to record. Seb, what was your highlight?
When we unveiled your overly aggressive Among Us behaviour, I think was, sure. was my favourite bit. That sure. was funny. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And Alex, what was yours?
I didn't have one.
Okay, just a flat line. Before we get started with today's episode, let me remind you that if you're keen as a football bean, you should be reading The Athletic. That's right, that's the official slogan of The Athletic there. They've just sent that note out this morning. That's what we should all be saying now. And you'll start to see that on television adverts and on billboards in Manhattan Times Square or something. Keen as a football bean, read The Athletic. The reason you should, if you are keen as a football bean, is because there is a fantastic in-depth and close to the source knowledge on every club. Alex, what am I trying to say?
You're trying to say that you should subscribe to The Athletic, and you're probably not saying it for this reason, but I had a piece out this morning on Phil Foden, which might be readable.
Yeah, it is. And it's a sort of expansion of the video that we've had out this morning on Phil Foden. Hello.
Vilvoden. Well. Yes, absolutely.
Vilvoden. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think everyone needs a source. The Athletic. Yeah? Every source needs a source. That's the line. Every source needs a source. The Athletic. And that's why when I eat chips, I mix ketchup and mayo. But visit theathletic.com/TIFO. That's theathletic.com/TIFO. And I believe you can get a deal that is as good as £1 per week. It's a fantastic thing to avail yourselves of. And you know what? Every time you go for a long poo, you're going to be delighted that you did. So that's theathletic.com/TIFO. Anyway, enough of this intro. Let's begin with the episode by talking about Manchester City and West Ham. So I will leave you in the cool hands and the warm embrace of Thomas Souček. Let us begin with talk of Manchester City 2-1 West Ham. West Ham, we're going to talk about West Ham because, listen, we've talked about Manchester City. They're going to win the league. Hum-dee-da, very fun, nobody cares. But West Ham, currently, I don't know what their current position is, but they are high up there in the upper echelons of the Premier League table. Here's a question for you, Seb. West Ham, a really good example of what can happen when a group of players are confident. Discuss.
Yeah, that feels like a rhetorical question. It feels like a question I've almost asked myself in that podcast.
In which case, let's move on and not listen to you anymore. No, go on. Do please tell me what you mean by that.
So I look at West Ham and I look at the players and I look at the system being employed, and it's all impressive enough, but there's nothing particularly innovative going on there. It's all just logical, logical implementation of a style which suits the players on the pitch. And what you're seeing, I think, is the effects of a group, of a squad, believing in what they're trying to do, having confidence in what other players around them are doing, and also collectively believing in what their manager is instructing them to do. And I think that's a really powerful sort of bedrock in football, because everything else kind of comes from that point, doesn't it? Because if you have the reverse, say you had a really intricate, innovative tactical system, which players either neither understood nor really believed in or had any, you know, particular faith in, it doesn't really matter. So it's like, mm-hmm. It's kind of your foundation block for team building, isn't it?
Alex, you're here with me, right?
Yeah.
Listen, are you ready for this? I'm going to try and create a division now. I'm going to say to Seb, cop out, yeah? Talk about intangibles, mate. When you don't understand what's happening, you put it down to good confidence and stuff that happens in people's heads that Alex can't measure with his protractor and his compass. Alex, Moyes has obviously been at West Ham before, and this did not have the same outcome then. Presumably there are pieces in place now. Maybe we're talking about a Lingard as a contributing factor. Thomas Soucek also, I imagine, is probably a player who's going to come up in your response here. But what exactly is it that West Ham, or Moyes is having West Ham do that is measurable, that isn't a cop-out answer like Seb's, that might be able to explain their position?
Yeah, well, they just want it more, don't they? I mean, that's right. The thing.
See, that's what I was thinking.
In every game. Seb's right. They have developed a system that suits what they've got. You know, there's some players in there of a very high standard. Declan Rice, I think, is excellent. Aaron Cresswell is excellent. But some of these other players they're good, but they're kind of workmanlike. But what Moyes has done is he's created a system where there's sufficient cover for all of those parts. The players know exactly what they're doing. Crucially, this is clearly a squad that is good at taking instruction and working hard. And so this kind of low block counterattack through quick players and Declan Rice's vertical passing, the forward runs of Soucek that kind of add bodies in the box, it's really well designed for what they've got. If they tried to be much more expansive, if they tried to play cleverly out of the back, that kind of thing, they wouldn't necessarily quite have the quality on the ball. What they do have is a lot of physicality, a lot of stamina. They can control the pitch well. They get their spacing right. And then they have one or two players who just add that extra bit of quality, which I think is, you know, Lingard is part of that now. But I would also add that Lingard works in the kind of the first half of what I've just said. He's actually a very, very assiduous presser of the ball. He takes up very intelligent positions. He marks the space well. So he fits not just in terms of what Moyes is maybe looking to elevate the team with, but also what the team's already doing well.
Yeah, okay. Well, listen, I'm going to pick on Thomas Soucek, Seb, because he's now been here for a year. It's amazing to think he's only been at West Ham for a year. I feel like he's been there for 100 years, such is his impact on that team. And 11 goals within something like 33 appearances is a very impressive return for a box-to-box midfielder, particularly of his height. He looks a little bit like a clumsy player at times, doesn't he? But he's had such an incredible impact on this team. Is he the sort of defining piece that Moyes did not have in place last time? His kind of Marouane Fellaini, his elephant man?
I think so. Obviously, a little bit different to Fellaini, but there are some similarities there, like in the sense that if you were playing five-a-side against Thomas Soucek, he's the kind of player that would receive a pass, turn away from you, and accidentally, on purpose, elbow you in the face. He's that, isn't he? He's probably one of those guys who'd just be absolutely horrible to play against.
Yeah, he's
very impressive. I think what you're getting at is that even though he's been there for a year, he's kind of indicative of what Moyes has built there. He feels very emblematic of what West Ham have become, which is rugged, tough, hard to break down, pretty reliable in both penalty boxes. And Soucek is kind of your... He's your sort of poster image for that, isn't he? Because he looks like what would happen if you asked a sort of a cartoonist, just, you know, on instinct, draw what a David Moyes player is going to look like. And pretty much, you know, your weird science, your modern version of weird science would be Thomas Soucek rather than Kelly LaRocque, I think.
Okay.
Is that a reference that went ever? Has nobody else seen Weird Science?
I've seen Weird Science. Yeah.
Thank you, Joe.
What is Weird Science? Put it in some kind of context for me.
So, I mean, sort of date. Mid-80s. It's, two high school kids. They create their perfect woman. And so this is, instead of the two high school kids, I've got, one David Moyes and his perfect box-to-box midfielder. And it's Thomas Soucek. Yeah.
Yeah. They wouldn't make a film like that today, would they? Yeah. Let me ask you now, weird science aside, let me ask you about Mikel Antonio, because he's a fascinating player. I mean, I remember when he first arrived in the league, he was playing as a winger, sometimes playing as a wingback. He's now firmly in the number nine role for West Ham. This is a player who's 30 years old now, but he started out in non-league and he kind of worked his way up over a period of time. We hear about players like this, but Mikel Antonio genuinely is a kind of... it feels like an unknown quantity in every game he plays. I feel like Premier League defences really don't know how to contain him.
Yeah, I have a little bit of a theory about this. Firstly, the player that progresses into the Premier League from non-league football plays in a slightly different way. I don't know how you measure it, but it's part enthusiasm, it's part desire, it's part chip on their shoulder about being rejected at some point earlier in their career. And that kind of manifests in the way they play the game when they get to the Premier League. With Antonio, I feel like the variety of positions he's played in the past helps him to be a little bit of an unknown quantity. So he does certain things on the pitch very well. I don't think he has a lot of established traits. He doesn't have, you know, for instance, he doesn't have skill moves which defenders can anticipate. He doesn't have a tendency to lay the ball off in one direction or the other. He is just someone that can do a lot of things to a really high standard. And that must make him very difficult to play against.
Can I put him in the context of my understanding of this comes from the game Rocket League. Do either of you play the game Rocket League?
No.
No. Rocket League is football with cars, right? It's a great game. But there's something that happens as you rank up to sort of different levels, different ranks, that the game is played slightly differently at each one of those. And at the very top level, there's a lot of faking going on, whereby they try to indicate a move and then they don't make the move. But because they're playing against people of their own rank, what you often find is that the game can at times be kind of slow with like people trying to fake everyone out constantly. And when you get a player who might have a slightly less skill level, who plays in a ranked match with players of that ability, you often find that they score the simplest goals because everybody's expecting everyone to fake all the time or to do a particular thing that they don't do. And I feel like Antonio's a bit like that. I feel like he has a really good game sense, but he's not necessarily the best mechanics, yeah? And he's playing in the supersonic legend rank squad, but people don't know what to expect from him, yeah? Was that a totally worthless thing for me to say? It was, wasn't it? Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
At the beginning, I thought, this is a great thing to say. And then by the time I got to the end, I'd leaned more and more towards I shouldn't have started saying this
kind
thing.
Of floundering on the analogies today, aren't we?
Yeah.
They're built all over the place. Has anyone seen this? No. Okay, well, let's go with it anyway. It'll make sense to someone. It's like
when I listen back to this podcast by myself, I'll laugh alone.
Yeah. I'm hoping there's one or two Rocket League players out there. Alex, what were you going to say before I did all that thing?
I was going to say that I think Antonio is, I mean, obviously there's a physical presence there, but I think as one of you said, there's a kind of funny instinct about popping up in the right place at the right time. You know, a lot of his goals aren't necessarily immaculate finishes or incredible shots from distance. He works very hard to get into the right position and then somehow manages to kind of wrap himself around in such a way as to knock it in. And what West Ham have, and again, this is very Moyes, is with particularly with him and Souček, you just have big guys who are able to time their runs into the box in such a way as to create problems for defenders. And because that's coming with pace and it's coming with height, then if they're able to attack across, then it's really, really hard to defend. And sometimes there is a little bit maybe that Premier League defences are used to having a kind of a type of constructed play in front of them, which is slightly more complex and works slightly more on quick passing and movement. And I'm not saying that West Ham can't do that, but actually having a more direct approach but being fed by players of genuine quality is something that defences struggle to deal with.
Do you remember Antonio at Southampton?
No.
He played at Southampton in 2009.
Really?
28 appearances, 3 goals, apparently. He was on loan from Reading.
Huh.
Interesting.
So he did, yeah, back in the League One days.
Tooting and Mitcham, Reading, Cheltenham Town, Southampton, yeah. Colchester United, Sheffield Wednesday, Forest. Nottingham Forest, West Ham United. 150 appearances for West Ham, 43 goals. Pretty good return.
Well, I've just been on his FB ref profile compared to other positional peers, it says, in Europe's top 5 leagues over the last 365 days. There's only 10% of players who've scored more non-penalty goals per 90 than him, and his non-penalty XG is only 2% of players that have managed more, which is an extraordinary kind of, you know, that
makes him an elite footballer.
Well, in terms of his output, it kind of does. I mean, the only things that he doesn't do that well are sort of passing and tackling.
Who needs to do that when you score goals?
Well, kind of, yeah, because if you're the focal point and if that's what you're looking for, you know, West Ham are not a heavy passing team. Their progressions are quite direct and they do like to cross the ball. So you don't need to be the kind of player that links stuff up all that much. You're there to create space for others or to get in the end of crosses. And he does that really well.
Well, absolutely. Anyway, speaking of Football League players, is Jared Bowen a good example of the Premier League snobbery towards Football League players, Seb? Jared Bowen?
I think so. I also, let me preface that by saying that I think this is starting to change. I think some clubs are having to look for value in the Football League and some clubs as a result are finding it. But Bowen was someone who was around for a long time. I know that Tottenham looked at him for a while and passed, and a few others. You know, if you look around the Premier League table now, for the money West Ham spent and for the output they've got, he represents a very good deal, and he's proven excellent. I think it's always it always feels like a secondary option, doesn't it? You know, if someone said, "Oh, right, you can go into the Championship," and you know, look how long it took the Premier League to wake up to someone like Ollie Watkins, who's had a very good season, or I know he hasn't quite set the league on fire yet, but Saïd Benrahma is. You know, he's a super player and presumably will prove that very, very soon. Historically, if you look at some of the players that have come up over the years, so Morgan Schneiderlin's an obvious example, Angel Rangel with Swansea, Leon Britton with Swansea. It's interesting what the kind of the margins are between getting a chance in the Premier League and not, and the players that would never have got one unless they've been promoted into it, if that makes sense. It's interesting, and I just think it's kind of it's a strange trend, and it's Premier League clubs are weirdly reluctant to kind of look beneath themselves, which I think is a mistake.
You know, Jared Bowen's got a style of play section on his Wikipedia, and he was described by sports journalist Daniel Emery as the budget Iron Robin. Which, you know,
that's nice.
Fair enough, I guess.
I think this is something that'll change, like Seb says, partly because there have been instances of players. I mean, Eberi Chietse is another good example of that. Players coming in and adding something from an attacking perspective. Who? Sorry?
Dele Alli.
I mean, going back, there's Andy Robertson from Hull's another, like Jared Bowen from Hull. That, you know, there are these instances, but I think the more that Premier League clubs, A, choose to gamble, but also because of the new GBE rules, they have to gamble. You know, if smaller leagues in Europe, if the clubs that players of interest are playing for don't get to, for example, the latter stages of the Europa League or the Champions League, it's harder for those players to accrue the sufficient points to get a transfer to England now. And so suddenly the Championship becomes more appealing because obviously those players are already based here and the transfer is more straightforward.
Well, here's a fact for you. I'm just picking a fact. Oh, good one. Mikel Antonio's equaliser for West Ham was the first Premier League goal Man City have conceded at the Etihad since the 15th of December against West Brom, ending their run of 629 minutes without conceding on home soil in the competition. Six home clean sheets in a row before today!
Well done, John Stones and Ruben Dias, then.
Well done to both of them. We've talked about Man City a fair whack already, so that's why we wanted to focus on West Ham. The exciting West Ham! Anyway, after this, we'll be back to talk about Tottenham versus a Burnley.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Tottenham 4, nil Burnley. Okay. Oh, there's a theme to my questions here, Seb, and I'm going to read them all in one go just so that we can just get cracking, okay? Question number one, is Gareth Bale good again? Question number two, are Tottenham good again? And question number three, what the hell is going on?
Maybe, no, I don't know.
Right, yeah. No, that's so, yeah, okay. That's pretty
that
good,
okay?
Isn't it?
Is yeah. that okay? Yeah. Do you want me to expand or am I done in that section?
I don't know. I really don't know. I feel like I'm a bit worried because I feel like we had this conversation and we have this conversation with Tottenham quite a lot. It's the Mourinho factor, isn't it? I feel like Mourinho creates a sort of cloud of confusion and I never know who I am when I'm near him. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't know what's real anymore. Tottenham, they looked outstanding against Burnley. And I know Burnley having a tricky season. Ordinarily I'd say a better defensive team than they have been for periods this season. But Tottenham just ran away with the game. I mean, every time they moved forward to attack, it looked like they were going to score. Gareth Bale, of course, had a fantastic performance, as we've discussed. Also, so did Harry Kane. I literally don't know what to say anymore. I feel like I've done this as a person with Mourinho for the last 5 years, where he does something great and I think, oh, maybe I'm a fucking idiot for thinking he was bad, and then he does bad stuff for like 6 weeks and I go, no, of course he's bad, why do I keep getting fooled? And then it just happens over and over and over again. I genuinely don't know what to make of it. That's why I'm asking you. I'm not sure that you know either.
No, I don't know. I've got a good rule which I've been applying over the last few weeks which has helped me a little bit, and that is that Jose Mourinho is as responsible for the good performances as he is the bad. So that means that when confidence is slumping and defenders are making mistakes and individual errors, he is responsible for that. But yeah, when a Gareth Bale or Dele Alli type re-emerges and starts to play well and shows flickers of form, also responsible for that. I think it's about being even-handed. And obviously, depending on your stance, at any given point, you kind of expose yourself to that weird little army of Mourinhoists online who attack anybody that kind of dissents. But that's the only way to do it. You can't have a situation where Jose Mourinho is only responsible for the good things and completely unable to alter the course of a poorly performing side. It's not the way. So you have to be even. And as long as you're even, I think it's fair to say Burnley's a good performance. Burnley is shit, but especially away from home, they are weirdly a very soft touch against Spurs and have been for a few years. But yeah, it was very good. It was fun to see Gareth Bale play well. I don't know whether Gareth Bale is back. Let's just leave it there. It was fun. It was nice to see him play like that again.
Well, no, I'm not. I don't want to leave it there. I'm going to say okay. Gareth Frank Bale, 32. He's going to be 32 in the summer, Seb. So even if he is back, he's not back for very long. But how does one explain that kind of performance?
He was a joke, unfairly. Gareth Bale hasn't done anything to show that he was finished, other than just not to play very much and. The reasons
all very
for
well.
Him. Well, let's be realistic.
I think that's fair to say, right?
Yeah, but if you look at sort of the amount of football he's played over the last couple of years and what you would reasonably expect a player to need to play himself back into form, I don't think Gareth Bale had reached that level. And I think it's not a coincidence that as his minutes have increased, so have his performances, so have the impact of his performances. He's a player who's had a lot of muscle injuries in the past. He's someone that has spent much of the past few years sitting in stands watching Real Madrid play, or Tottenham. Yeah. And he is
his
also getting older.
Average of 25 appearances a year.
Yeah, then that's across three competitions, or four, as in Real Madrid's case. That's not a lot.
He's had a lot of injuries, and he's also had this issue where players have been promoted ahead of him, particularly at Real Madrid, because of a perceived star quality or something. And as players get older, particularly off the back of injuries, those players have to adapt their skill set, which we've seen with Cristiano Ronaldo, for example. But if you don't get regular game time and you're not trusted on the pitch to be given the opportunity to adapt your game, then you end up not being quite one thing and not the other. You don't have the physical attributes to be the player that you once were, but you also don't have sufficient time to be able to work on, you know, privileging the elements of your game that don't necessarily change. Like Gareth Bale is still very good at passing, very good at heading, and very good at shooting. So, you know, if he were given the opportunity to fashion himself into a player that works more on that basis than on an explosive physicality, I think you would have seen him continue to be a very, very good player.
Seb, Tottenham are currently in eighth position with a game in hand, 6 points off West Ham in fourth place. Presumably, you know, fourth is, it's wide open for every team in that area, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. I think what will end up happening is that Jose Mourinho will privilege the Europa League. And if he loses any more ground in the battle for fourth, I think that sort of prioritisation will become more clear. You'll see players being rested in at the weekends and saved for midweek matches, especially as the competition gets harder towards its latter stages. I don't know. I just they've got a nice run of games and a couple of games in a row that they really should win. Then they have to face Arsenal at the Emirates, which feels like a little bit of a lottery at the moment because I don't know what Arsenal actually are, and I don't think any of us know what Arsenal are. So I don't think so. I don't expect to Tottenham to finish inside the top four. But I think if they were to put in a decent showing in the League Cup and finish sixth and have a bit of a crack at the Europa League, I think given how low this season has been at different points, that would be a relative success. Not a success and not by any means par for Mourinho, but still better than it could have been.
Okay. Anything else on Spurs?
No. When you started to interrogate me, it reminded me of playing Among Us with you over the weekend, which, by the way, I've a bone to pick because I sort of turned up as someone who'd never played the game before, and I didn't really realize sort of how aggressive some of the questioning would be.
Oh, there's no mercy even for newbies.
Yeah, but Alex, even people like Paul Ansorge, for instance, nicest man I've ever met, nicest person I've ever met.
Yeah,
put him in Among Us, and he's like a character from 12 Angry Men.
Paul Ansorge, no question about that. Yeah.
It's like you're in 12 Angry Men.
Have you noticed how Joe also establishes himself as the foreman of the jury at
he's
every quite, given
he's,
opportunity?
He's an absolute
everything
Henry
like
Fonda.
A meeting. Yeah, completely.
Yeah, he's a Henry Fonda, and it's kind of like, right, why the fuck were you in storage? You know, what were you doing there? Like,
listen, listen. There are very few rooms in which I'm not the foreman. Okay, let's just say that.
Also, other point of note on that is Henry Cook, our illustrator, excellent liar, really good liar. Yeah.
The only thing I've got to add is that I was watching Match of the Day last night, and Tottenham came on, and Mourinho's face was on the screen, and my mum just went, ugh.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
All right, okay, let's talk about Chelsea 0-0 Manchester United. This was a fairly fun game, particularly the first half was fun. The second half was a little bit more boring. First thing I have to say, point of order. We don't normally talk about handball things or on-pitch controversies or was it this or that or whatever. But I genuinely don't understand the handball rule anymore, and I need somebody to explain it to me.
Oh, God, this is my bit, isn't it? Okay.
This is your bit.
Right, listener, please excuse me.
Just say it in your own words, Seb.
Yeah, but I... Oh, okay, fine. It is a handball if a player, one, deliberately touches the ball with the hand/arm, including moving the hand/arm towards the ball. Two, scores in the opponent's goal directly from the hand/arm, even if accidental.
I can't hear you. I can't even hear what you're saying. What's the bit that's relevant to us, do you think? I'm looking
hang on,
as well.
Hang on. Point two is, it is a handball if a player scores in the opponent's goal directly from their hand slash arm, even if accidental, including by the goalkeeper. What the shuddering fuck does that mean?
What? Scores in the opponent's goal directly goalkeeper, from
the... If the goalkeeper goes up for a...
Oh, yeah, to the opponent's goal.
Yeah, but what's the need? What? So we're clarifying the fact that the goalkeeper can't go up for a corner and punch the ball into the net. I mean, that feels like true, a... Yeah, but... I mean, I feel like I knew that. I mean...
An important clarification.
Yeah, okay. Well, also handball. Joe, stop.
You're not Henry Fonda now, Joe.
Are you going to read all of these?
Okay, this is my Among Us meeting.
No, read them all. Read them all.
I will. After the ball has touched their or a teammate's hand slash arm, even if accidental, immediately, and then A, scores in the opponent's goal, B, creates a goal-scoring opportunity. C, touches the ball with their hand. Oh, for fuck's sake. I don't know. I can hear myself reading this stuff.
Fall off by the dozen.
Handball is complicated.
No, keep reading. You shouted at me. You've got to keep reading now. You wanted to keep reading. Keep reading. Go.
Point D. It is also handball if the player has made their body unnaturally bigger. We don't really know what that means because that seems to be subjective.
That's more like weird science, isn't it?
The hand is above shoulder level, which seems to be the same point to me because that...
Like Hudson-Odoi's, yeah.
Well, like Ndidi against Arsenal. I suppose that would be the example for that one. But then that also seems to be involved in the making their body unnaturally bigger point. No?
I think that the ex-pros often talk about lifting the arms to gain momentum with a jump. I mean, I don't know if that's... that. I wouldn't say that's unnaturally bigger.
Relatively important ones. And I can see you moving around on the Google Doc as I read this, by the way. I can see your cursor. So it is not a handball. If the ball... Stop doing that to distract me. Stop it. Stop it.
It's so childish.
If it is not a handball, if the ball touches a player's arm, A, directly from the player's own... Alex, stop highlighting the text. If the ball touches a player's hand directly from the player's own head or body, directly from the head
Can
or
I
body
go to the
of
toilet?
Another player who's close, if the hand arm is close to the body and does not make the body unnaturally bigger.
Sir.
I'm done.
Can I go to the toilet, sir? Listen, maybe the answer is that I don't understand the handball rule because I can't bear to read or hear anyone else read the handball rule to me. But would you agree that the handball rule doesn't really make that much sense in terms of the way that it is currently applied, or at least that the referees applying it are responding perhaps to a negative response to the change in the rule at the beginning of the season? Because this handball incident, Hudson-Odoi, it was certainly... an incident that would have been given at the beginning of the season and should have been given according to the rules, but is now not being given because...
It's because no they got idea. Such negative feedback and because it became such a thing at the beginning of the season. They
so
very
they're on
clearly
the fly,
had,
right?
Yeah, they. I actually asked this question. When we went to Stockley Park a couple of years ago before they introduced VAR in England, I said, will there be little adjustments to the rules? Like, will the laws and the application of the laws and what constitutes a high bar, will that be tweaked privately? And they said no. But very clearly, this is what's happened. Handballs, if you look back at sort of the handball given against Eric Dier against Newcastle back in October, I think, and then compare it to what happened at Stamford Bridge over the weekend. It's a handball. And you can't have a situation in which within the same season, there are multiple variations on the same law of the game. It's just ridiculous.
Well, there's also the one that Southampton didn't get when the ball, when yes. Matty Cash stuck his right arm out.
Yeah, handball. Absolutely handball.
And I think the problem that we had, obviously, before VAR, there was inconsistency in decisions, but human error means that there will be inconsistency in decisions. Now we have this kind of spectral presence that's supposed to oversee everything and correct errors and make sure that everyone gets a fair crack of the whip. And that's what's added this extra degree of confusion, because you're thinking, well, surely that's a handball. It's only a matter of time before VAR overrules it. And then there's this confusion over whether or not VAR can actually overrule it, or just...
That's what they said, it's a handball, come and look at the monitor, and he overruled them.
And then he changed it. And my understanding of VAR was that it was supposed to be able to say to referees on the pitch, you've made a mistake, you need to correct it. But for the referee to then be able to turn around and go, whatever his justification for that process was, effectively, I haven't made a mistake, or even if I have, I'm not going to give it anyway. That's just weird. It just adds another level of confusion. I mean, that was a handball under the rules.
Well, to add a further layer of confusion and controversy, Luke Shaw commented about this after the game. I'm going to do my best impression of just a generic footballer now when I read Luke Shaw's quote. Are you ready?
Go on.
I even heard the referee say to H, if I say it's a pen, then it's going to cause a lot of people to talk afterwards.
I think that was my Paul McCartney. Wait, I was trying to do...
also, Luke Shaw, very, very southern.
Yeah, I know. I'm not doing an impression of Luke Shaw, guys. I said before I started it was a generic footballer. It just accidentally turned into Paul McCartney. I even heard the referee say to H, square brackets Maguire, if I say it's a pen, that's going to cause a lot of people to talk afterwards. Now, of course, Manchester United said he misheard, and they encouraged him to say that he misheard. And whether he did mishear or not is unclear. It seems like a strange thing to mishear.
He seems to have misheard very precisely.
He does.
He was having a very animated conversation with Ben Chilwell as both players came off the pitch after the game. I wonder if he was saying, like, what on earth happened there? Did you hear it as well?
He was probably saying, I can't believe you're not even getting to start at Chelsea anymore. I can't believe I'm going to the Euros and I'm going to be in the starting position. Enjoy the bench, Ben.
That's possibly what he was saying.
This has been derailed by me too many times. I don't even know how to respond to this. This feels like an absurd situation to be in. Let's just say hypothetically, let's just take as a hypothetical the scenario that the referee did say this. It's crazy, isn't it, Seb?
It is crazy because I'm not sure what would then happen next. Because
is it understandable, though?
Not really, because I think it's understandable for a referee to think that way. Not that it's good that they do, but it's a very strange thing to articulate to a player. You can't say, well, yes, you probably should have a penalty in this really, really, really important top of the table game, but I'm not going to give it because publicity? Question mark. That seems strange to me. That's the kind of thing that the FA probably have to respond to, or the Premier League, or PGML.
If it is what was said, I think what I'd like to know is, was his rationale that because this element of the handball rule is so weak that it's sort of contentious, that's the problem? Or is it because it's giving Manchester United yet another penalty? Is it a Manchester United thing, or is it a rule thing?
Is Stuart Atwell leading a kind of revolution from the inside?
The other way I would look at it is imagine, like, we don't know how we very rarely hear quotes of how referees and players talk to each other, right? We don't know about the formality, we don't know about the familiarity. I'm sure that Stuart Atwell and Harry Maguire have spoken many, many times before. Maybe, is it possible that this is the sort of thing, or along the lines of the sort of thing that you might say in order to defuse a situation, to say, look, that's not something I can give? Maybe that's what he was trying to say. I mean, because I remember watching the game and seeing after the decision was to not give a penalty, I was a bit confused, saw Harry Maguire going over to talk to Stuart Atwell, and he, it's not like he did any kind of massive complaint about it after... You can see Stuart Atwell talking to him, and then he kind of just, and then walks off again. You think if a referee said something to us that sounds very, very unusual sort of thing to say, right? Harry Maguire's reaction did not read that at all.
That's a really good point. Yeah,
maybe so, he's polite.
I don't know. Maybe he's polite. Maybe this is just an ordinary way that referees and players talk to each other. Maybe there's a bit of a solidarity, we're in it together thing. Maybe it's been misinterpreted, and what the referee meant was, I can't give that. You know, even if you're saying this is what happened, I still can't give it. Maybe that would be fine. Maybe it's, as I said, it's something in order to try to diffuse the situation.
Yeah, maybe he was trying to make a joke.
Maybe he was trying to make a joke.
He might just be a really fatalist person. Maybe to be kind of, well, it's just a game of football and, you know, we're all going to die anyway. So, I mean, you know.
Maybe, yes.
That's, I don't know. Well, welcome to my world.
It's like, but just like a fatalistic centre-half. I don't know. Maybe.
In the Six Nations game between England and Wales at the weekend, which I caught like the last 10 minutes of or something. There had been a series of refereeing controversies prior to that, but the people, the pundits were able, and also the players themselves were able to respond to that much more clearly, because in rugby, the referee is mic'd up. So you can hear the conversations that are being had. The studio can clock into that, and then everybody who's watching is aware of what's being said. And I think that partly it keeps the players from being particularly offensive or intimidatory, or I know there's a different culture in rugby around refereeing, but it would also have been incredibly helpful in this instance, or possibly would have prevented Stuart Atwell from saying something ambiguous or silly. If he knows it's going to be broadcast, he can just explain clearly, I'm not giving it for these reasons, and then we'd all know.
Have you guys ever seen the footage of when they did this for an Arsenal game back in the 90s, when it was David Ellery got mic'd up, and Arsenal Adams conceded a goal. Tony Adams, the goal's given, David Ellery runs back towards the halfway line, Tony Adams chases him, shouts cheat in his face, and then runs off again. I don't think it's going to work. I don't think you can mic up football referees.
But it's been done in the A-League in Australia, and it's very successful, because the referees are aware that the explanation that they give to the players is also being broadcast to listeners, and the players are conscious that if they act in a certain kind of way, it will reflect badly on them, and there's tangible evidence of them being offensive or aggressive. And I think it might have teething problems, but ultimately it seems like quite a good solution to a number of different problems.
Big, sweary teething problems. Yeah.
Sure, but you know, Sky are used to apologising for profanity, aren't they? Which I've never really understood, because half the time you've missed it or it just hasn't sunk in, and then they apologise for it, and you think, oh, what got said? That sounds exciting.
I believe it to be a legal fucking requirement. Anyway, we'll be back after the break to discuss something from Germany. Oh, we're in Germany now. The weather is broadly the same. We're on the same sort of latitude, and people are similar. Everything's fine. Seb, tell me about RB Leipzig versus Borussia Mönchengladbach, por favor. Bitter.
This is great. It was the best game I've seen in ages. I kind of tuned in with the rest of Germany, kind of hoping to see Leipzig win, because as my father-in-law tells me, it's just, if it's a unifying thing to kind of rage against the prospect of Bayern Munich winning the league. So,
you said his English wasn't very good.
No, but his English is okay. It's just it's a lot better than my German. I'm only 6 days in. No, but we have.
I want you to quote your father-in-law directly. I don't want you misquoting your father-in-law on this podcast.
No, because we talk through gestures and motions and facial expressions as well as words.
Tell us what happened. Just tell us what happened.
Do you do that thing where you speak like louder and with a slight accent of the language of the person you're communicating to, like English people do?
So,
before you answer this question, Seb, let me just put some context for listeners here who don't know. Seb has recently, with his wife, moved to Germany. They're waiting to move into their own accommodation, and for a month or a while, he's staying with the in-laws. Your wife's father doesn't speak. He speaks some English, but not loads, and you speak some German, but not loads. But you're watching a lot of football together.
That's pretty much it. And so what we've been doing is I'm 6 days into my German lessons, and my sentence structure is really poor, obviously, but I'm starting to pick up bits of vocabulary just from studying, but also because obviously my wife talks to her parents in German around the breakfast table, around the lunch table. And so when we communicate, I'm able to kind of do 60% English, drop the occasional German word in, and we kind of communicate that way. My father-in-law's English is actually very good. He doesn't use it enough to be confident. It's one of those. But, like, do you remember when you studied at school? You did sort of French or Spanish, but you never actually went to France or Spain. It's the same principle. So he just lacks confidence. But his English is actually better than he thinks he is. But
we have you learned any swear words yet?
Yeah. I mean, Aktorscheiß, of course. Yeah. Like, it's that stuff's pretty easy to pick up. But sure. you know, were like the utility company to call me after this podcast, I would probably need to get my wife to deal with that. That's the kind of, that's the difference.
Well, I'll also be doing that here.
Yeah.
They're speaking English too. Anyway, back to the football. Your father-in-law enjoyed this game. He likes to unite against Bayern, and it seems like you do too now.
Yeah, we got really into it. Obviously, Gladbach went into a two-goal lead, and I'd be like to say, I think it's really interesting to kind of to see the conditions within a game in which Julian Nagelsmann thrives, because this game became very chaotic, but in this really thrusting, impressive way from RB's perspective. It's really some statistics from that second 45 minutes. Bear in mind, they're 2-0 down. Second 45 minutes, RB Leipzig, 14 shots to nil, 68% possession, 120 passes made and completed within the Gladbach final third. They were so dominant. And it was really interesting to see, because at no point, even at two goals down, did it ever look like they questioned their belief to go and win the game. And it's kind of full circle with the point that we made about West Ham right at the beginning. It's a set. Kept on battering away, battering away, battering away. And eventually, Crystal Palace legend Alexander Soloth scored at the back post in injury time to win the game. Great header, by the way. Very soft challenge that didn't come close to preventing him from winning the game. But it also, maybe Gladbach would have been better served by actually challenging for that rather than all like seven players running to the referee in protest as the ball was crossing the goal line. But either way, fun. Really good game of football.
Let me bring this back to England for you, Seb. What future team is Julian Nagelsmann going to manage in the Premier League? Yeah?
I don't think that's all we care about, really. Yeah, I don't think he comes to the Premier League. I think there's some sort of...
Really?
I think there seems to be... Well, I've heard the reports, like everybody else, that he is interested in Tottenham, and Tottenham would theoretically be interested in him. But I think he probably moves at the end of this season, and I think he has always been destined for Bayern Munich, I would have thought.
Oh.
I'd be very surprised if he doesn't go there. If not this summer, then at some point in his career, he's going to manage Bayern Munich, isn't he? I think that's
it's such a boring funnel, isn't it?
Yeah, it is pretty tedious. But then that doesn't just apply to managers in Germany, does it?
No, players, of course, too.
Exactly. Yeah. There's just a mass migration towards the strongest club in the country. I'd certainly like to see him in England, just because I'd like to see him compete with Guardiola and Klopp and potentially Mourinho. That'd be interesting, but I can't say.
I'd love to see that flex, you know?
Yes, me too, yes.
Oh, well. After this, we'll be back to do Joe's database of quotes and facts. It's Joe's Quotes and Facts Database. It's the Quotes and Facts Database. And I've got one addition today. So, Alex, would you like to hear about Andreas Christensen?
Nothing would give me more pleasure.
Oh, well, that's good to hear. Andreas Christensen, of course, Chelsea centre-back, known, here's the fact, known as the quiet, humble Dane. Yeah? It's exciting, isn't it?
What do you mean?
Humble
is that a
Dane.
Nickname? So, like,
that's a nickname, or known if as.
If he went home to his nom de local town and someone saw him walking down the street, that's what someone would shout out.
No, it's just that when he did his translated Ulysses, translated it into Danish, his pseudonym was the Quiet Humble Dane. That's okay. It's a legal name.
These nicknames aren't exactly catchy, are they?
No, I'm not sure they're real either.
There was one,
I'm finding them from one
website. What
was the
website. One you gave in the last episode?
The bird.
Oh, it was for Edouard, the birdman.
The tall doorkeeper. The
tall doorkeeper. Can you imagine, like, in the frenzied dressing room atmosphere at Chelsea, people are sort of bouncing around and like, oh, Christian this or Kante that, and then quiet, humble Dane. Like,
I think they sound like they're translated into English. I think that's why they're funny. Anyway, again, I've gone to my best resource. I don't even know why I'm doing this. Everybody should just go and read lifeblogger.com. It really is the best resource for quotes and facts, and I've chosen the strengths, weaknesses, likes and dislikes list again just because I had a lot of fun. It's not a quote; because I couldn't really find any good Andreas Christensen quotes. Tell a lie, I've only just realised it's not a quote. Of course it's not. And I've just picked two facts. So this is just a flax and flax list today. But according to lifeblogger.com, strengths, here we go. Andreas is courageous, determined, confident, enthusiastic, optimistic, honest, and passionate. That's a lot of good things, isn't it? Weaknesses, his humble looks are often taken for granted. his looks represent someone who could have been bullied while in his youth.
That's not a fact. That's a completely insane inference. Oh, somebody put a comment under the last pod. The thing that I was referring to is the Barnum effect, which is where you read a generic thing like a horoscope and pull out what you feel applies to you. So yeah.
Well, I think this next thing is very specific. I'd be curious to see if you can apply the Barnum effect to this. He likes taking on leadership roles, physical challenges, individual sports, and playing in the pool with friends. Do you not think that sounds really specific to?
That was all fine until playing in the pool with friends. That was really strange.
But on the website, at this point, there's a photo of him in a pool with some other Chelsea players. And they're playing
in
the pool.
Is that not just an exercise session?
I don't know.
Maybe he enjoys that as an exercise session.
There was that series of photos that came out from the England camp, wasn't there?
With the unicorns.
With the unicorns, yeah.
What, in the pool?
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with a good old unicorn.
Maybe that's been brought into Chelsea by members of the squad that were also involved in the unicorn incident.
Maybe it has. Just enjoying yourself in a pool. That's nice fun. Dislikes. This is the last bit now. Dislikes. Inactivity. Doesn't like inactivity. No one likes delays. And work that does not use one's talents. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Nobody likes that either. So that is Andreas Christensen. Didn't get a quote for him.
It's because he's too quiet and humble to say anything.
He's too quiet and humble to say anything. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I think that's it, isn't it, for today's episode? Is that right?
I've had enough, yes.
I sincerely hope so.
We've got midweek football coming up. I'm just checking the fixtures now, see what we'll likely be talking about on Thursday's episode, because Tuesday there's a City Wolves. What a thrill.
The busy night is Thursday, so we might be caught between fixtures. You'll have to forgive us when we get to Friday morning.
That's true, because we record on a Thursday morning. This is going to be one of the rare incidences in which we're incapable of our usual game relevance, unshaking game relevance. It will shake every time Thursday is a big night. But we've got Burnley, Leicester, Sheffield United, Aston Villa, Crystal Palace, Man United. So there's something to sink our teeth into, and maybe we can, have a bit of fun or something as well. Do something else that's less game relevant. Who knows? Maybe we'll see. Game relevance working out okay for you, Alex?
No, not really. But I might watch Lille against Marseille on Wednesday night.
All right, yeah, fine.
Instead of Premier League games.
Yeah, that'd be exciting.
I think Sampaoli's taken over at Marseille, hasn't he? So that might be might be fun.
Jorge, hello. Seb, you enjoying yourself with game relevance?
Yeah, I'm going to watch the Hamburg Derby tonight. So my wife supports Sampaoli, her brother supports Hamburg, and her dad supports Hamburg as well. So it's going to be quite a voyeuristic football watching experience tonight to see them all.
What does your wife support Sampaoli? Is it because she's a hipster?
She used to work for Sampaoli a long time ago. One of her first jobs out of university, she used to work for them.
That's why I've got a Sampaoli badge on my laptop, because she sent it to me.
Listen, mate, I used to work for Tesco. I don't support them, yeah?
You do have a Tesco badge on your laptop, though. So.
I actually never worked for Tesco. Do you know what? I've never worked for a big company, apart from the one I work for now. Right, that's the end of the podcast now. So thanks for listening. Thanks to Alex.
My pleasure.
Seb Stafford-Blore.
Thank you, Joe Devine.
and as usual to producer Adonis, and we will be back on Friday with some less game relevant chat for you. Au revoir.
The Athletic.